Welcome back, my friends. And I'm so sorry for the unexpected hiatus. There have been lots of hard things and much needed family time. So I thought it was only right to attend to my own quality of being. But now, a long-awaited welcome back. We're here in season two of Creative in Process, a podcast where I talk with everyday humans on what it means to be creative in the 21st century. I'm your host, Lisa, and I'm also a speaker, leadership and spirituality coach, and content creator. And I believe all of us are creative, whether we're engineers or athletes or musicians or accountants. Yes, accountants. And what better timing than our episode for today, where I chat with the spectacular and beloved Jessica Gath. And don't go anywhere, creative friends, because I guarantee you're going to be needing what this woman is putting down into our conversation today. Let me introduce her. Jessica Gath is a possibilitarian who makes artwork in paint, garments, zines, food, correspondence, community, activism, songs, dirt, plants, videos, and whatever else gets the job done. For almost 30 years, the concepts behind her art practice have been to connect us humans in our shared humanity and to strengthen perceptions of our oneness with Earth. Today, Jessica and I chat about, well, literally everything, but in particular, why we should see ourselves not just as creatives, but citizens, why we should get uncomfortable artistically and listen to even our strangest dreams, why artists and foodies are often soulmates, women's magazines, and how to say no to things that drain us, how to accept that we're beloved and missed by someone, why smiling first increases our own quality of being, why we should dance even when dancing is hard, how art and silliness can disarm both dictators and creepers, and how we can stay open and surprise ourselves even in old age. And perhaps most importantly, I encourage you to stick around to the very end of this episode to hear the answer to this question. Why are Bostonians known to be less friendly? I'm super excited for this chat, so are you ready to dive in? Let's go. I am so excited for this conversation with you, Jessica. I remember the last time we chatted, you had been extroverting so much in New York that you lost your voice because of how much you talked.
True.
I just have to name how comforting that is for a fellow extrovert and ex-New York resident like myself. There's lots that I was struck with when I first met you and chatted with you, but one of the things that stuck most is just your creative dissatisfaction in the very best way. You have this generative discontent that leads you to live at the intersection of many spaces that might seem incompatible to others. Part of that looks like marrying art with electoral work. I love how you said that at various stages in your life, just painting pretty pictures or just focusing on raw advocacy wasn't enough. You don't want to just do gentle creative things. You also want to pursue measurable change that's relevant to our daily lives. So I would love it if you could just talk a little bit more about what this journey towards this intersection of art and advocacy has been like.
Sure. So when I first started seriously pursuing art when I was around 25, I was doing portrait painting and all oil painting. And then with the death of someone I was living with, I was a living caretaker for my friend's mother, I really shifted away from that toward connecting our bodies to earth. You know, I was raised in the Catholic Church, and so the whole like dust to dust thing had always been in my mind. But there was something about that period of living with somebody who really kind of turned into a living skeleton, that the skeleton became really clear to me. And then the connection between like a skeleton and a tree, they look the same. And wow, we're actually just nature. And so that's the work I was doing when George W. Bush was elected in 2005. That time period politically was so difficult for me. I was so let down by all the things that happened around him getting basically like put into office by his brother in 2000, and the wars and the negativity and the lack of shared humanity I was seeing. And it just pushed my work further toward wanting to cultivate a sense of humanity and shared humanity, that was really the focus of my work for like 11 years after that. It would manifest in like a generosity practice. So trying to model generosity, just trying to be generous, trying to share avenues for seeing one another as unique and beloved. Once the 2016 election happened, I was like, okay, wow, that's not enough. It's not enough of a way to live here now. It's not participating in democracy, which is participatory. It's not enough. I had been taking a break from artwork for a couple of years when I was living in New York because I just couldn't figure out how to do it in a new community, since my work was so community focused and community embedded at that time. With that election, I really dove back in, and all the work I was doing was about engaging as citizens, whether it was like dismantling the patriarchy that had allowed this to occur, or engaging in like simple instructions for how to be active. That's kind of where I am now.
Yeah. I think it's just so beautiful to listen to how you allowed yourself to be affected by the atmosphere in each of these evolutions of your journey. It feels like it's rooted in something so deeply personal in your experience of, wow, the skeleton, that's us, that's like a tree. And that being so emotionally and personally connected and embedded for you into, I'm moving into a season where these changes all around me are just drawing me out into new and novel spaces, but I feel like I need to be here now. What would you say like helped you to kind of usher into these new evolutions of yourself and your work?
I started those evolutions when I was in graduate school at Massachusetts College of Art, and I started in the painting program there, and I didn't paint a single painting in graduate school, maybe one. Just like, you know, and I didn't really understand how transformative my environment was for me until I was in that space. And I was like, well, I guess I was painting before because it's a thing you can do in a room. But here I am in a situation where I have so many rooms available. I have rooms for sculpture. I have rooms for glassmaking. I have rooms for ceramics. I have rooms for showing videos. My making doesn't need to be limited by what's available in a regular house. And then also, of course, I was being opened up at the time to different types of artwork with the guidance of my professors and my classmates to have a context for it and not just be like, I don't understand what that is. First, I had to have that kind of metamorphosis or transformative experience of realizing like, wow, art is what artists make. It's not a specific thing. It's like what comes out of artists. So that was the first transformation. And then once that one occurred and I could access my studio practice and my creative practice, then what comes out is what comes out. It's more like staying attuned to that listening and that openness to be like, well, I guess this is what I'm going to make now. And I had plenty of opportunities in that in the years leading up to 2016 to get really uncomfortable artistically. I mean, to this day, I have a series of dreams that they're pretty personal and they're all bathroom related.
What? But that sounds amazing.
So I was having
share more.
I just would like always have these like really embarrassing dreams where like, and this is leading somewhere related to your question, where like the worst one was like, I'm at my best friend's parents' house and I'm like, hey, I have to go to the bathroom. I don't know where it is. And he's like, oh, it's in there. And I go through this door and I'm like right about to pee. And then I hear his mother being like, and here's my brand new walk-in closet. And the door starts to open and she's giving a tour of her house to her friend.
Oh.
And I'm peeing in her walk-in closet.
Oh, no.
And whole years and years and years of dreams like this one. You know, people are like, maybe you had to pee. And I'm like, that's not what this dream is about. I did not have to pee.
It's never about needing to pee, Jessica. It's never that simple.
then this roommate moved in with me. Like, this was just such an act of synchronicity. This random guy I met on Craigslist, such a sweetheart, and we've been in each other's lives forever since then. One morning he's like, "How's it going?" And I was like, "I just had another one of those really strange dreams." And he was like, "Jessica, those are performance art dreams." And I was like, "What?" He was like, "You know, all my roommates in undergrad were performance artists. You're a performance artist. Why don't you know that?"
Wow.
And I was like, "Oh my God, I am a performance artist." And he was like, "Well, luckily they all started a gallery about a block away. So I'll introduce you to them. You can sort this out with them." And he did. And I did. And it's been like a remarkable thing ever since. Anyway, that was like a really uncomfortable. I mean, I make it sound easy, like, "Oh, I'm a performance artist. Great." I was not that psyched to hear that. I was like, how did I go from being like this just really nice oil painter to like now I have to be a performance artist and dream about going to the bathroom? Why can't I just be like what I thought this was going to be? So that's how I got to a facility with like, okay, now what?
What a story. Let me tell you how that struck me. This is a complete tangent. But when you said toilet bathroom related dreams, I have had so many bathroom related dreams. That's the only recurring dream I have as an adult. And it is so visceral. And it's always where it's like, I cannot find the bathroom. And when I do, all of the toilets, this is very visual. I know this isn't a visual medium, but all the toilets are dirty. They are occupied and people are like naked. They are unclothed. This is completely not representative of my waking life, but like I'm just totally convinced that I'm just stuck in this large city of a sauna where every single toilet is just taken up and it's just like this nightmarish maze of toilets that will not let me use them. But that is pretty scary to have a lady walk into her closet with you. So thank you for sharing that very vulnerable story. That's kind of like a highlight of your many evolutions. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. I want to take us back briefly to what you had said about art is what artists produce. Art is what artists create. I love that. I don't think I've heard it spoken quite like that before. But for me, what I hear is that who we are informs what we do. It is out of our fundamental identity as an artist that is the spring from which we issue forth the things that come out of our hands. And I heard you mention the word beloved as I wanted people to know through these acts of kindness that they were beloved, whether it's conviction, faith, values. How do you feel like this background you've come from or the experiences you've had, how has that informed then the way that you see the art that you produce?
I really love a lot of people. In part, it comes from being so extroverted. Probably what gives me the most energy is having small incidental interactions with the most strangers. Mm. I work the election, and on election day, we arrive at 6 a.m. We leave at 8:30 p.m. The entire day, it's short interactions with different people over and over. Mm. You know, like that's like foundationally who I am. Of course, I have acquaintances, neighbors, friends, best friends, beloved family, chosen family. Just so much love for so many of them for what they bring or who they are. Or the performance I have done in my life that I feel like is kind of the pinnacle of my artistic career in a lot of ways is called For You, I Feel Lucky. And it's a celebration of everybody in the room. And it's like, I feel lucky because I am here with you, whoever you are. And the performance, it requires an RSVP. I do a little research about everybody first in their community based on whoever they send me to and really learn what their people love or appreciate or observe about them. And then I write a performance about everyone who will be there. My requirement for myself is that I need to really feel the feelings of being in that performance. And there's one example that I just always come back to. And it's like one of the people in this room, at least one of the people in this room, is deeply missed. I feel like that's probably true of most of us. it hits me so hard. And I think about who I miss. I mean, I can barely talk about it without crying because, like, we're all so precious to somebody. So that's the sort of thing that I was working to cultivate in my work. That sort of beloved, like, we are all beloved by somebody. It could be a dog. It could be a bird. It could just be Earth.
I would argue that we are all deeply beloved by the Earth and yes. somebody's dog.
True. Yes.
My dog would happily make any of the listeners deeply beloved to him. That's so beautiful. To be loved is to be deeply missed by somebody. I don't know. There's just something so universally true and tender about listening to that. I just love that word. Because it's also an invitation to be loved, to be, and also to be particularly and specifically loved. That's also the right word of reparations as I think about how who you are has informed what you have created over the years so deeply. It is a product and a outpouring of your beloved nature.
Thanks.
I would love just to hear a little bit more about your love for nature, for the earth. And you've done lots of work in the environmental justice area. If you just talk a little bit more about how that passion and love for the earth was birthed and kind of kindled over the years.
I'm not sure, which I wonder if that's because it's just so old in me. I will say that my father's parents lived on a beautiful small piece of land that my great-grandfather came to build a house on when he came from Italy at the turn of the 20th century. And he did everything from building the house. He planted pear trees. He planted apple trees. He dug the well. That land was a labor of love for him and a home for his family. And so by the time I came along in the 1970s, the trees were real. And actually the basement had a wine cellar and it was like a house made by an Italian man. Mm-hmm. So my great grandmother's canning was actually still on shelves in the basement. She died before I was born, but like no one had eaten the canning. And so it was just this fixture. And I always would look at it and think of it as like, wow, like that's the food that grew here that our Nonna put there. And also I really love cooking and I love food and I love sharing a table with people and feeding people. And I imagine that my passion for earth and our connections to earth also is connected to food.
I'm thinking of the word fruit and how fruit is used metaphorically for what comes out of you and what comes out of your life and the fruit of our artistic endeavors. So I don't know. I love that. I love how there's a language of bringing forth and nourishment and things like that with everything that it sounds like you enjoy that I, by the way, also love, like Italians and Italian food and wine. So this is great. I really, really want to get to this. So in a society with so much going on in terms of factions and loyalties and culture wars, hyper-negativity in media, you have carved out such a beautiful portrait to me about political hope and also just unity. I remember you said we don't all have to do that much to get what we need and want, but we all have to do something. You've engaged so expansively in both these artistic and political spheres. I think of artists and politicians as both truth tellers in very different ways about the human condition. What has it looked like for you to hold on to hope over the years?
Certainly, it is a practice that involves learning. I try and learn when I eat breakfast. I eat breakfast every day. Mm-hmm. I try and read something that nourishes my mind in some way that I'm seeking. I have to exercise like a certain minimum amount every week. I make sure I get enough sleep. I practice cutting out things that steal my energy. That includes like women's magazines for the most part. Like that's a stark one that I realized in college, actually. I was like, these make me feel bad. I don't have space for that. I'm very intentional about not getting bogged down in complaining. either my own complaining or other people's complaining. Like a legitimate complaint that's brought with intention of addressing it to change life for the better, of course. But like complaining without action, I can't have it. And then conversations with my people. I have just a core group of people who, if I'm having trouble keeping hope, I know I can talk to at least one of them and regain a sense of purpose and who I am and hope for the future.
Yeah.
And since 2016, that formula has leaned really heavily on political and electoral action.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So when I had that realization in 2016 after the election that I needed to engage as a citizen, not just as an artist, I went to civil rights lawyers and I was like, what should I do? One of them sent me to Showing Up for Racial Justice. It's a welcome to social justice work spot and then funnels people's labor toward causes that are already being worked on by people who very frequently are directly impacted. Like for me, I came in, I got my kind of orientation with Showing Up for Racial Justice, and then I started immediately working to end mass incarceration, in part because Ta-Nehisi Coates had written that mass incarceration is like the worst evil of our lifetime. And if we can help the least among us to achieve what they need and want, then we can all have what we need and want. And some might argue that incarcerated folks are viewed as the least among us. Mm. Over the years, I shifted from doing specifically ending mass incarceration work toward electoral work because a more democratic presidency opens the door for the potential for less incarceration.
Mm-hmm. I love how you landed in this interconnected theme of mass incarceration and how pervasive it is across different spheres of social justice. I wonder, like, when you first came into the scene, how is that like for you just being brand new? You brought your heart, you brought your curiosity, and you were told, go over there into racial justice. I'm just curious because that's a huge world and opened up even more avenues for you, it sounds like.
Well, I mean, I wasn't new to social justice work, or at least to trying to do social justice work. When I lived in Boston, which I have for most of my adult life, I taught at MassArt and I learned about bell hooks. Mm. She is a leader for me toward what I want to create in the world, which is beloved community. Mm. Bell hooks was like, white people always wonder why they don't have friends who aren't white, or they have so few friends who aren't white. As a white person, you can't just be like, I want black friends. She's like, if you want to have a diverse community, do the work of spreading justice, do the work of building beloved community with everybody. And through that, you will have a more diverse community. Practice radical courtesy. That was her advice. And I was like, wow, I can really do that. I can practice radical courtesy. That is not asking too much. And what does that mean? That means be the first to smile. Black people and Black men specifically were always required by dominant society to be courteous. And I mean, no matter how courteous Black men are to this day, they're still getting killed by the police. Mm-hmm. Like that's a requirement of Black men for survival. And it can be extended by white people first as a radical act. Me smiling at my neighbor who smiles back at me, we're building beloved community on the street. Mm-hmm. So that was a practice I had already. And when I moved to New York, where the streets are less segregated, because Boston is very segregated in my experience, like I would very rarely see people who weren't either white or Asian in my day-to-day moves. And I was like, how is this possible? Mm-hmm. Like, this is a city. Where is everybody?
Yeah.
So once I moved to New York and I was like, oh, wow, everybody's here. And I got to really practice that radical courtesy. When I practice radical courtesy with especially Black people, it is received in a way that feels very human and very like the kind of human who's connected to Earth. Mm. I We are creatures. We all know when another creature is near us. At least I can speak for like my experience of white culture on the inside and my experience of white culture as a human attempting to practice radical courtesy across humans is that white culture has people unseeing one another. And it's taught as like a acceptable and maybe even sometimes the most acceptable behavior. Don't see them. Don't see anybody. And we're taught that it's unsafe to see people, that we can like hide from one another by having like dead eyes when we go past one another. We cannot hide from one another. We are creatures. But we can hide our humanity. And then like, why?
Yeah.
And when we be humans together, it's so beautiful. I've had so many of like the most beautiful moments in my life. Like sometimes it becomes a giggle with a stranger. It can be some of the most beautiful human moments. Probably I asked a civil rights lawyer because I was already trying to do this work. And I was like, I know the rubber is not hitting the road for me. Like, I know I'm practicing radical courtesy day to day and I'm seeing things that I hadn't seen before about whiteness, but I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to do more. When he said, go to Showing Up for Racial Justice, I was like, thank you. Those are the people I need to talk to. They'll help me know what to do.
Yeah. I think some amazing, beautiful, heartbreaking gold has come out of this tangential wandering. This really elemental language you have of like the earth, humanity, seeing. The temptation and sometimes the curse of living in this culture can be that unseeing is more natural and unseeing is the easier thing. But I think there is a cost, perhaps more so of unseeing than seeing. Seeing is so painful. It requires a lot of work. Sometimes it feels more natural to our humanity and our human instinct to dig into the earth with whoever it is on the street radically. Mm-hmm. I did that when I was in New York, and I love that you do that. But this kind of practicing, working it out, letting it touch your skin and trying it out, and that's hard. And so I think it's beautiful that you describe how natural of an instinct it is to see each other regardless of where you are across this racial identity table. I think I have this image of soil because you talk about the earth so much. It's like as a white person or as someone who's been just privileged in any sort of identity, when you're standing in that place of cultural privilege, holding out your hand in the work of racial justice to lift someone out of the soil so they can breathe out of the soil a little bit because they've been mired in it. But in doing that act plants you more firmly and deeply in it so that you can breathe more easily in a different way. There's something deeply humanizing about what happens to both of you. And I just love that. That sounds like the work that you are doing, choosing to show up for something that other people are forced to show up for. That is really hard work, but it's so beautiful.
I just want to be clear, like, it is not hard for me to do that. Yeah. I like it. It feeds me. Yeah. There's such a payoff. Now, I think there can be for probably a lot of people. It's not only for mega extroverts. I mean, I'd love to know. I'd love to be in a world where people are trying.
Or at least placing themselves in a position where they risk discomfort, but find themselves surprised. Or anywhere in the middle. The fact that it's not hard for you, I think, is even more beautiful to me because I'm someone who really feels that in my jellies when you say that and how natural that's intuitively for me, but feels very unintuitive for a few of the circles that I'm in. So I just want to talk about this too. One of my favorite things you've said is if we learn anything from the past, it's that we as a human race beloved community have an enormous opportunity and possibility for evolution. And one form we found of doing that is using art to reimagine protest. I also love the performing arts and would call myself a performing artist. So I loved it when you said that this can look like dance and singing. Revolution can look like going crazy, jumping, clapping, and twirling around. So can you talk a little bit about what stirs in you as you think about this very beautiful portrait of revolution as song and dance?
When we talked last, I loved you talking about revolution as a re-evolution. It hits me in such a happy way, just like the practice of dancing and singing and again, like beloved community with other humans. Let's use On the Street as an example, because the two examples that strike me are when it was after the 2020 election and there were election deniers going around wanting to stop the counts, and they arrived in Philadelphia. And of course, we were like, no, every single one of our votes count in a democracy. All of us need to get our votes counted. We went and met them where they were trying to stop the counters. I wasn't there at first. My partner went straight away. I had a food distribution thing that I had organized because it was still COVID times. Mm-hmm. There was a call. Can you come, please? Everybody who can come, come, please, now. We need to count the votes. And my partner went and he was like, he texted me shortly after, he'd be like, can you please come as soon as possible? I finished my thing. I rode up there. I was scared. I never know what to expect, you know, heading to a large gathering of humans trying to make a point. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, parked my bike, locked it up, and I was like, is that a klezmer band? Right next to me was a klezmer band, and like all these people like dancing like crazy all around this klezmer band. And I was like, okay, if that's what we're doing, you know. So I was like grooving to the klezmer band a little bit as I headed into the like larger group of people. It was the most epic dance party. It was not what I was expecting to find. And like, it was an all ages rock out mega dance party. And it was so fun. And like, everybody was there, all kinds of people. If you are a human, you could probably find somebody who was like you who was mm-hmm. there in many ways. Mm. So, you know, I just have to spread a little Philly love for a second, because Philadelphia has the most amazing music, DJs and musicians and whatever. And like the collaboration between the music community and the DJ community and the radio station community, and to like just keep this party rocking for days was so beautiful and so fun, so inspiring. It really showcased what is possible when we collaborate, and when we're like, what do we want this to look like? And we shout out what we want it to look like. Yeah. And, you know, I definitely got there and I was like, thank you for making it look like this. We went there every morning and we left every evening, and everybody wasn't there the whole time, of course, but like, it was what, like 4 days? There were amazing puppets and sculptures and signs and babies and children and old people and our elected officials. And it made me so grateful for the creativity of the community to be like, what do we want? We want a world where we are free to dance and sing and enjoy our lives. For that, we need all of our votes to be counted. Count all our votes. I know historically that Estonia was taken over by Russia. They had changed hands multiple times, perhaps as a way of saying it, that the people were passed around, the land was passed around, and Russia was there and doing, I think, very much what they're doing in Ukraine right now. And Estonia, due to their like deep singing culture, which I guess all humans have a deep singing culture, so maybe that's like a human thing. They sang together, and in doing so, had a nearly bloodless revolution that successfully expelled Russia from Estonia. What an amazing picture. Mm-hmm. And what an amazing reality. And what an amazing way to assert desires and needs and wants. Like, what do we want our lives to look like? This is what we want them to look like. Let's do it. Not like we have to do a terrible thing now so later our lives can look like our lives, like we want our lives to look.
Yeah. Both anecdotes, really. The first one was very visceral. I feel like I was pretty sure I lived in your body as you were describing yourself entering into that scene. The more recent bloodless revolution comment you made brought like, like everything you're sharing is evoking things that I'm like are like questionably appropriate for me to share. with all of COVID and some of the movements with BLM and Stop Asian Hate, it's been, you know, questionably as safe to be outside later at night. And so my husband jokes with me sometimes. He's like, you know, if you ever have like a stalker, even if it's like broad daylight kind of situation, and he's just following you a little too closely and doesn't seem like he's a good energy, he's like, you should just turn around and just very disarmingly dance, flail your arms, and make like monkey or monster sounds. And I feel like that will just probably do it. And like, you know, I have like a really aggressive, concerning way of distorting my face when I really don't want someone to be dealing with me. And he's like, and you pull that out too. That's how it felt when I thought about, you know, disarming Russia. If someone comes in with malicious intention, individual level, communal level, I feel like dance and art and singing and these creative acts that are just so human and so beautiful and so fun and so silly sometimes are really quite disarming. And in some ways, in their disarming nature, almost like I guess comedy is for quite a few folks in the cathartic way that it's disarming, is healing just by nature of experiencing it, and even more so when you participate. And so I just love how beautifully disruptive that scene was both for you and for an entire nation.
Well, and I should add, in the note of what's easy for me and what's hard for me, dancing has been very difficult for me for most of my life. I'm not like a person who's like, let's go dancing. And then I'm like hitting the dance floor and having like the best time ever. Like, thanks to my New York community, I learned that I'm a groover. I will groove. I groove a lot, actually. All that to say, for me to arrive at a dance party and be faced first with klezmer music, which I'm like, I mean, I can groove to anything, so okay. It's like, you know, this is a little out of my comfort zone and everything, but like, if this is what I have to do to, I don't know, I'm talking in the Muppet voice. If this is what I have to do to like get the world that I want, like, this is not bad at all. It's really fun when I'm compelled to do it. I'm not doing it because I'm trying to be cool. You know, like, I hope my dancing looks awesome. But like, if it doesn't, I'm not here for that. I'm just here to dance with everybody. Mm-hmm. It may be easy for me to look people in the eye when I walk past them. It is not easy for me to dance.
But you're a groover. Okay. Very helpful clarification. And another helpful clarification for those who don't know what klezmer is, because it's such a cool thing, but it's also such a cool eclectic thing. Eastern European Jewish belonging to the Ashkenazi Jews, including dance tunes, ritual melodies, and virtuosic improvisations played for listening, according to Wikipedia.
Yeah. Super cool.
Yes.
Very cool.
Yes.
I have literally never once in my entire life put on klezmer music to dance to it in my home, but...
And maybe I should tonight. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think another thing is when you were painting that scene with that klezmer group rock out hang was this idea that like art is vulnerable, right? And when you bring people together under it through dancing and singing, for me, it's like this collective vulnerability. It's an expression of collective vulnerability where suddenly evolution and change becomes open and you allow your change that you're contributing, you're allowing that to become dependent on the person next to you. And it reminds me of the expression, I'm paraphrasing, but like, I'm lucky for you, whoever you are. Mm-hmm. And this kind of active way to demonstrate that one way I'm lucky for you is that I'm allowing the change that I engage with in this moment to be fluid and malleable and dependent on you. And I just love that.
I really love how you said that.
I guess for the sake of time, I would love to hear about one of the campaigns you're working on right now, but maybe that's like a plug for you to go check out Jessica's stuff. She's working on so many things, and I'm sure some form of that is available somewhere to someone. I just wanted it to be available to me right now, but I did want to touch on the last question I force feed to everybody who has the pleasure to chat with me here, is that I began a topic in season one of this show in quality of being, which explores the quality not just of our external lives, but also our internal realities. As society is externally seeking all this amazing visible progress, how do we continue to foster and discover our own humanity as fellow citizens, as you say, Jessica, of this earth? We ask not just where are we headed, but who are we becoming? Mm. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on quality of being and kind of how it connects to the where and the why and the how of this conversation or anything that is top of mind for you.
I was thinking about the ways that I've been surprised. For instance, I had an idea that when I got old, I was going to become more bigoted and I was going to become angrier. And maybe I would like to say that again without implicating my grandparents' bigotry, but I thought I knew what people who were older were like based on who my grandparents were. You know, I had this very large extended old person family when I was little, and I thought I knew what people were like as a result of that survey. Like in my late 20s, I did elder care to support myself when I was in school. And I took care of a woman who was like 96 when we met. And we became amazing friends. And I learned so much about being a human from her because she was so open and so engaged and so creative and still interested in what was happening in that now. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, wow, that's what a person can be like. And she would still surprise herself. Like, she fell in love with baseball. It was when the Red Sox were winning for, like, the first time in the century. She was like, I might be a fair weather fan, you know, but she was like, I'm so surprised. I like baseball. And I was like, wow. Okay, so I could be surprising myself for the rest of my whole life. And I can stay open. That is a thing humans can do. All that to say, I realized so much of my quality of being comes from witnessing other humans' qualities of being and seeing what's possible from that. I don't think it's the only place I see possibility, but I think it's one of the strongest in that like monkey see, monkey do sort of way. Like, oh, you could do that. I could do that. So I think that informs my quality of wanting to like be with everybody and everything in a quality state. Like, I don't want to just like hover near all of it pretending I'm by myself. My quality of being is I want to have a quality experience of being with y'all.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. You took on a little bit of a voice and I was like, me too. But being in that quality of being then becomes very active and participatory and extension of relationship. We can so easily default to this individualistic interpretation. So I love how your almost natural response, like right away, was, yeah, it's me being with other people in quality relationships. There's a withness, not a with the d, but a withness. That was hard.
Witness or withness?
A withness.
Our microphones are not thanking us right now.
No, I will probably have to wipe it off after this.
Say it, don't spray it.
Yeah, that's right. You being like, oh, allowing myself to be surprised by people who allow themselves to continue to be surprised when they're old, and just knowing that they exist. A Spanish friend was over at our place yesterday, and I was like, you know, the last time I felt like a little girl frolicking in a meadow was right before I dreamed of taking a trip to the south of Spain. And that's because like when I went into that region, everyone I met in that community just did not feel like they belonged there nor anywhere else on the earth. And it was beautifully unexpected and surprising for me how well they fit with each other in their misfitness and how welcoming that shared understanding of none of us have really truly felt a sense of belonging to one place. And yet, because of that, We are not closed. We are in this perpetual state of wandering and yet open curiosity toward humanity and all of the different shades that it can take. And I felt at home there for the first time in a long time, or maybe ever in that particular way. And I came back to the US, like boomerang came back, felt like I was called back to not live in Spain, unfortunately, but called to bring that back here and apply that to my mentality of living as a citizen of Boston, because Boston does not necessarily at large, in my personal at large experience of Boston, I am the person to smile aggressively and creep people out on the street, apparently. So that was uncomfortable for many years because I have been there for many years. That just coming back here, knowing that there are people who existed in the world, like those I met in the south of Spain, was enough to preserve and maintain, but also foster what my quality of being could look like back in Boston. So I love that you did that and you allowed yourself to talk to that lady and you continue to explore this posture.
I love that you were able to bring that home with you.
Yeah. That was not very easy. That's like the dancing for me. Ooh. I just wanted to thank you so much, Jessica, for being with me here today. We have covered a beautiful storm of all the things, and I couldn't have done this without you.
Oh, wow. This has been such an enormous pleasure. I feel so inspired, and I feel like we built beloved community today. I'm just grateful for the opportunity to go down the path of your brain with you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Isn't Jessica such a beautiful human? Honestly, I hadn't met her before doing this episode with her, but talking to her just felt like talking to a piece of my own soul in another body. And whenever that happens, isn't it a wild and wonderful ride? I'm just so moved by the strength of Jessica's soul and by her candid humor. Today, she reminds us that our quality of being has a withness, with a th. Our greatest potential, our greatest re-evolution happens in our being together, when we show up shoulder to shoulder to groove together in life. So choose your tune today, my friends. And whether you live or work in music or tech or education or healthcare, I invite you to stay open and dependent on your fellow humans. Laugh together, giggle together, outsmile one another. Allow your quality of life, allow the change you're working in the world to be affected by the person next to you. A stranger, classmate, friend, a neighbor, let them bring you joy. And you may be surprised what you find. You can learn more about Jessica at www.jessicagath.org or on her other sites, fullyrooted.com, artistcommit.com, and 5millionstrong.art. Don't worry, I'll have all of these links in the show notes. Again, this is Lisa, and thanks for joining me for this conversation of creative in process. I'll have new episodes up every month, so be sure to follow and stay tuned. Also, I'd love it if you could leave me a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It helps me know what I do well and how to make this space even better for listeners like you. So thank you in advance for your help. And with that, talk to you again next month.
I have a lot of theories about like the friendliness in Boston. I've thought about it a lot and talk about it a lot.
I have thought about it a lot and talked about it less than I'd like to. Talked about it a lot and then realized that people didn't want to talk about it a lot.
I want to talk about it.
It makes me want to talk about it. It's like just the fact that Boston is so transient. I'll just leave it there.
It's that. That's what it is. People don't want to get their hearts broken. So it manifests as not wanting to open their hearts. And they have right on red, which I think is like, it's a curse. It's stressful enough driving in Boston more than anywhere else. And you never get to rest. Whereas everywhere else, you just rest until it turns green. Like that's your turn off time. It's good for humans.
The built-in traffic laws that are supposed to help you rest aren't functioning here.
They don't exist.
They are just null.
And when you are a pedestrian, since you always have the right of way, cars always have to be like on the lookout for you, like, oh God, are they going to run out in the road? Because people definitely are. And then you have to stop. I'm thinking about this one example in JP where it's like so hard to cross. The people who want to turn right are looking to the left with their foot like so ready to slam on the gas to like jump in front of the car that's coming. And like you have to like run across the street before that car like tries to hit you without realizing that you're there. You can just never rest. You're like, so there's that. And then people are like, I'm only here for 2 years. And they really are.
You sound like such a freaking native right now that I almost forgot you are located in Philly right now. So what I'm hearing is basically behind every mass hole is someone who is terrified of having their hearts broken.
I kind of think so. Because so many beloveds just come and go and come and go and come and go.
Man, the transience of the beloveds.
Yeah.
I feel like that's like an orchestral piece.